try again.
And welcome to Fishing the Wild West on KayakFishingRadio.com. I'm your host, Dennis Spike from KayakFishing.com, joined tonight for the very first time by Isaac the Nothing Miller in Portland, Oregon. He's our new co-host, and he's going to help give us a bigger, broader perspective on the West Coast and the Great Northwest. Hello, Isaac. What's shaking on your line?
Hey, not a whole lot up here. We got a salmon season in full swing, so everyone's biting at that right now.
Well, that's more than a whole lot of nothing, I tell you.
It's almost standard fare these days.
You know, it's after so many years of not seeing them, it's a great thing to see. I was writing an article for Outdoor Life today talking about the pilgrimage, how anglers and boaters and campers tend to choke up the highways when the salmon are here. You know, I wanted to remind listeners that although the show's on the West Coast, and how do you like that name, the Wild West Show, Isaac?
I like it.
You know, while the show's on the West Coast, we welcome everybody's questions and comments about the sport from everywhere, and we want to hear from you. Log on to the chat room at KayakFishingRadio.com or call into the switchboard, and we'll put you on the air, so to speak, here on Kayak Fishing Radio. I got to tell you guys, I lived deep in the woods about 3 miles from this closest tiny little town. And when I got back to the home office to queue up the radio show, the signal from my satellite dish, the internet signal, kept dropping out. So I went through a little panic, and I called Chip, and I called Isaac, and I headed over to the mouth of Bodega Bay. This is where Alfred Hitchcock shot the movie The Birds, with Tippi motoring that little skiff across the harbor. And it is just so cool that a couple of things are really cool. One, that I could have such a technical problem at home and throw everything into the car, little notebook, computer, and my telephone, and get out here and do the KayakFishingRadio.com show and watch the boats, the pleasure boats and the commercial boats coming in and out of the harbor. And since I'm sitting here at the harbor with the windows rolled up so the seagulls don't give us any static here, as I pulled up, I get a fish report. A guy is loading his kayak into his van. He drove over here from Sacramento, which is probably 2.5-3 hour drive, and he went crabbing. Dungeness Crab doesn't open until November the 5th, but he said he got a lot of nice red crabs, and his traps were full of fat, healthy, clean-looking Dungeness crabs, which means we're going to have a really good crab season. And that is about 6 weeks before the opener at Dungeness, so I'm really excited about it. One time a buddy made a comment about all the crab that we were catching, and actually it was Cousin Howie who made the kayak fishing video. And he said, you know, when you steam those things and you put them in the freezer, it's like they're on their own, they're in their own natural casing, and they last forever. And they really do. I busted out a bag of red rock crab claws the other night, re-steamed them just to heat them up, and they had been frozen in that Ziploc, not even vacuum sealed, in a Ziploc bag for 6-7 months easy. And I made some of the nicest crab cakes. It was just, I really do like every different thing we can do on the kayaks. What do you guys got to say? Don't let me hog this show.
Yeah, hey, you know, very similar report here in Oregon. Of course, Dungeness is open right now, and crabbing reports that I've been getting have been excellent as well. 9-hour soaks, very full pots, and that's in the bays and just outside of bays in just outside the jaws in the ocean as well. Just excellent, excellent crabbing going on up here in the Northwest. So
I'm really glad to hear it. You know, I think as anglers, all of the media that we key into, the intelligent angler anyway, I think that over the seasons and over the years, it builds a much better picture of the fishery and, for me, makes me a better angler. And I really never thought about the natural cycle until 17 years I've been going to my cabin. And on the 17th year, a mountain lion walks into the middle of camp after midnight. Now, we knew there were cats in the hills, and we had heard them, and we had seen the signs. But we never had any kind of problem like that. And it wasn't just us. It was a known problem throughout the area. And I finally got a hold of a fish and game biologist, started asking questions about, you know, why are the cats a problem now when they haven't been in so long, when I'm seeing more deer than I've ever seen. And the biologist had a real good lesson for me. And that was, well, you should know these things because you're a fisherman. And you know that cycles aren't necessarily seasonal. Most people have a spring, summer, winter, and fall, you know, thought about a seasonal thought about every season they approach for the fishery. But the truth is, you know, why do we see good years of salmon and bad years? Why did the sardines, well, the sardines are not a good example because that was clearly overfishing. But when you take the pollution factors and overfishing factors and then the true natural cycle, the reality is whether you're fishing or hunting or picking flowers, some years are good and some years are bad. And the more we pay attention to all this media and our own fishing, I think the better picture we get of the fishery. And, you know, the crab thing, while we're pleased as punch about it, there were other areas last year up into British Columbia when we had a good crawl down here. There were areas in British Columbia that weren't doing so well. The crabs weren't in the high volume in those areas. The commercial guys weren't doing so well. And the truth is, when the kayaks are down here picking up literally hundreds of pounds of crab through the course of the season, the prices never really went down in the stores because so much of it was being shipped to areas that the Canadians had in the years before supplied, probably when the bite was no good down here. So that whole last year, we talk about all this, that whole last year, I think the median price that I saw on fresh Dungeness crab in the markets was still about a little over $6 a pound. You think about going out and getting 10 a day on your kayak at $6 a pound, 10 crabs, maybe 2.5 pounds each. That's some worthy fishing, I tell you, and some good eats.
That is. You know, my understanding of what happened in the last year as far as the retail market for crab was that China actually developed a taste for Dungeness, is what I was told. And retail prices up here are up to $10 a pound now.
The bad news show is on Thursday nights.
I'm sorry.
No, I'm just kidding you. This is really, really relevant stuff. Now, that isn't something that I had heard of, but I'm not surprised. There's the whole uni, the sea urchin roe,
right,
which is a major West Coast and Baja California, Mexico commercial fishery. We're talking virtually 99% of that catch is being flown directly to Tokyo. And there is, you know, a part of fishery conservation and sustainability has been, and it's a delicate topic, but it shouldn't be, is some countries' insatiable appetite for seafood. You know, we really benefit. And hey, just for your information, you guys, I'm not getting a return on the flash room, on the chat room.
Are okay.
You guys getting it okay?
Let me get back into it.
Okay, yeah. I'm not reaching it. Let me know that if anything's going on there. Oh, actually, my server was down. It just reconnected with you guys.
Okay.
Anyway, you know, the insatiable appetite to some countries. One of the things that has crossed my mind is I hear, because of kayakfishing.com and the outreach that we do to provide information for anglers, for kayak anglers, I hear from anglers virtually from all over the world, and it's a great thing. I know where the hot spots are for fishing. I talk to guys in Germany who are fishing when you wouldn't think anybody in Europe was fishing. Spain, Italy. It's unbelievable how this sport has taken off. But there are a lot of countries where outdoor recreation, sports, all this stuff is real popular. We're not getting a big return from Japan, and I think it's because of the damage of the fisheries, to the fisheries. I hear more people kayak fishing in China, the China coast, than I do Japan. Now, our benefit, and I'm not trying to put these countries down. I'm trying to point out the slow recovery that it takes when you really hammer these nearshore fisheries. Now, I've always maintained that because of our lack of invasiveness in the kayaks, that we are able to appreciate recovering fisheries before head boats and party boats, before the guides who have to make a living at it in their power boats. We're able to get more opportunities on the water, be more patient, learn a concentrated area better. And I see it on every coast of North America and beyond. I see kayak anglers getting into the fish that weren't there for a long time when nobody's getting into them, and actually bringing attention to recovering fisheries. So it's all good. But again, you know, commercial, as recreational anglers, and for those of us who are writers and in the industry and feel compelled to give something back to this blessing that we're able to, you know, make a few bucks in and make a livelihood out of. I've always been on the fence with good mentors between the recreational and commercial fishing industries, because the truth is that we have to live a parallel life. Sounds like I've been watching the United Nations all day, but there are real parallels here. There are real parallels here. I've always felt compelled to ride the fence and try to bring together these two interests, because we're codependent and we need to coexist. The reality is, in most cases, that the commercial take compared to the recreational take is so out of balance with commercial interests getting the sheer volume of fish, and in a lot of fisheries, especially California, recreational anglers suffering for it by overregulation, the whole list of ways that anglers limit regulations, cut seasons. But overfishing by the commercials is not all of it, and it's so easy to get caught up in that rat's nest of pointing fingers and blame. The reality is, these two entities that both feed people and bring billions of dollars into the commerce of our societies, have to coexist together, and wiping out the fish stocks is not the way. So there's a check and balance there between the two entities. I was trying to drive into my topic for tonight, which is going to be a lobster issue, the Pacific lobsters. Isaac or Chip, did you want to lead with anything else?
No, you and I are pretty much agreeing on a lot of things right here. I don't know how many people that listen to your show have checked in on my show at all, but I'm also a fishmonger by trade. So I spend a lot of time, if I'm not fishing, I'm dealing with fish. And
not everybody,
you know,
knows what a fishmonger is.
Basically, go to your meat department, look at the butcher, look at the fish guy. That's me.
That's a fishmonger.
So, yeah.
A fishmonger is a traditional term for the guy who sells fish. And back in the day when we had our first significant commercial markets, New York, Philadelphia, Virginia, the Eastern Seaboard, the fishmonger typically didn't have a storefront. He had a cart, and he sold fish going through the streets. And
right off the boat,
it's a great title. and an honorable profession. Go ahead, Isaac.
Yeah, thanks. But I deal a lot with sustainable seafoods. I mean, that's one of my company's, you know, most prideful things, is that everything that we do is as sustainable as possible. So I agree with everything that you're saying so far. So
I think listeners, just staying with the topic but going off the subject a little bit, most listeners have probably noticed in the news in the papers lately, there's been a lot of controversy about the fish that you're buying in the store, talking about groupers and snappers and sea trout and sea bass and what anglers are actually getting. There's a lot of fraud. Now, this is fraud in the meat industry, whether it's red meat or fish, has been is historic. But the reality is we have a much higher sense of consciousness now, not only among consumers, which I believe are the driving force, but among fishmongers and buyers and producers. Now, these articles that have been coming out talked more about substituting fish for species. They talked about a lot of the farmed fish. And when we refer to healthy and sustainable, just because a fish is farmed doesn't mean it's necessarily sustainable. And, mm-hmm. and even fish that are farmed in a potentially healthy fashion, and what I'm talking about here is a lot of our offshore fish that are coming to the United States, and fish like catfish and trout and tilapia that are being raised in areas with no conscientiousness whatsoever, and with less than 1% of the imported fish being tested, some of these studies are showing that more than 50%, in some cases more than 60% of the fish they're testing has bacteria, salmonella, is poisoned with antibiotics, and this is a lot of the stuff you're seeing in your fish market. Now, there's only one person who knows where your dollar is going, and that is Isaac and your fishmonger. They know, you know, and I don't know if many people know too much about the fish business. This is exciting to me. I mean, I remember when Isaac told me he was a fishmonger, I got so excited because one of the early companies that helped me grow the sport is a fish wholesaler I want to say Hawthorne, California, but it could be Torrance. And it was DiCarlo Seafoods. I don't know if you've ever heard of them, Isaac.
I have not.
And I learned through Mark at DiCarlo what the fish market is all about. And it's basically about flying fish around in airplanes to airports around the clock. And I remember the first time I went to a sushi bar in Denver. It was about 30 years ago, and it kind of freaked me out because I'm like, I'm about to eat raw tuna and other seafood delights, and I'm 1,000 miles from the ocean. And I realized when I met Mark that the whole thing, and I'm sure you'll agree with me, the whole industry is through the airport, even for domestic fish. They're not putting this stuff on ice on trucks anymore. So the fish we get potentially, I mean, not potentially, the fish we get in the store, it starts out fresh. So it's a matter of handling and processing and what your fishmonger is buying for his clients. And it's exciting stuff. There's some great fish out there, and there's some great fish that you can eat and feed your family and feel good about the fishery and the quality, what we refer to as the chi of the fish, the chi mm-hmm. of the food that you're eating. And exciting stuff. The first time I walked into one of the coolers, the refrigerated rooms at DiCarlo, I was blown away. It was my first stop in Neptune's kitchen, man. It was unbelievable. It was like Neptune's seafood pantry. I mean, they're flying in mussels and clams and uni and urchins and fish in fillets and whole fish, bags, boxes. On one side of the room is a cascade of chipped ice coming down from the ceiling. And it really is an amazing thing to see the commercial workings of our fish industry. It really, and it's something, you know, whether it's a guy motoring out of this harbor on his boat checking his traps or putting down his lines or the guy sitting behind the counter. This is all part of us. There's really no soulful difference between the recreational angler and the commercial angler. And both of them, and I got to stand up for the commercial angler, have their place in I want to say American tradition, and maybe an American tradition in a much bigger way. And again, I just got to interject there that California in the last 10 years has led the way globally in fishery conservation, and very, very exciting stuff.
Yep. California's done some great things. There's been some not so great things, but
ain't it the truth? Yeah. I got to tell you, I I've been doing it for years, and I still credit the Alaskans and the Alaskan model for fishery sustainability. I don't know if I've talked about it on Kayak Fishing Radio before, but the Alaskan model, while as successful as it is not without controversy. And while I support it real strongly, there's some ugly truths to it, and there are some not so ugly truths in these industries, and I saw it for a long time in recreational fishing, where you'd get on a boat that was going out overnight to Catalina, and it was a charter boat that held 30, 35 passengers. Well, they'd sell 40 tickets, and all of a sudden 10 people wouldn't have bunks. You know, they advertised live bait, and they brought out dried anchovies, and the crew wasn't there to help. And they're just nightmares. And I think a lot of what I call the bad party boat industry, a lot of those guys, a lot of those operations, I should say, is what drove scores of us to the kayaks. Because for years and years, those kayaks were sitting there while the companies who made them tried to sell them to divers. And I think, especially in Southern California, where I believe the core of the sport really started, it was especially so in Southern California. And I think what happened because of the economy, because of the change in the fishery, and the change in attitudes, and the growth of conscientious thinking and sustainability towards the fisheries, a lot of these what I call scow fishing operations, the one you go on once and would never go on again, and because of the internet era. Because before the internet era, these operations could survive for, I saw some of them survive for decades. But because of the internet era, people don't live through ongoing bad press. They either fix their problems or they don't. So a lot of them got weeded out. But going back to the commercial industry, unfortunately, there's a lot of old-fashioned fishing operations that don't exactly fish ethically, and they don't have a sense of concern for the future of the fisheries. And I wish I didn't have to say it, but it is true. What happened in my evaluation of Alaska bringing on what I call the Alaska model for sustainable fisheries is all the little operations that were taking advantage of the system and not operating with a sense of conscience really got pushed out. Unfortunately, a lot of conscientious anglers who were little guys and weren't able to stay in because they were little guys, literally got pushed out of the fishing industry in Alaska. And I see that's going to happen as that model works its way down the coast. And it's an unfortunate thing. I hope that the West Coast anglers in Washington, Oregon, and California, the commercial fishermen, I hope that they have the foresight to see what happened in Alaska, see what happens when we start regulating the fisheries conscientiously, and be able to get together so they can work in cooperative situations and a sense of togetherness to maintain their positions and be able to keep fishing. On the other end of that, it makes for healthier, sustainable fisheries, because the truth is we're going to never stop using the oceans to feed the world, even in the most conscientious, and especially and hopefully in the most conscientious fashion. But we're always going to eat seafood, and we got to do it the right way. You know, we talked on one of the shows earlier in the week. I think it was Wheeler's show. We mentioned the jumbo squid here on the Pacific, Eastern Pacific Coast. And there's a strong body of thought that the squid have expanded their range on their own because of impact, detrimental impact to the tuna fisheries in the Pacific Ocean. So there's a theory that's being explored now that the giant squid have moved into nearshore areas and could even be a contributing factor to the collapse of squid populations, not blaming it solely on it. I'm sorry, the collapse of salmon populations coming out of the Sacramento Delta system and even the Klamath in years past. So, you know, this is serious thought. I mean, I'm writing an article on jumbo squid talking about the discovery of a new fishery, and it might not be welcome news if that's the fact.
Yeah.
I think. What do you think about that?
Well, I don't think that there's any much debate up here. We know jumbo squid are moving north. We had them wash up on our beaches, you know, in years past, especially El Nino years, as opposed to La Nina years.
But hasn't let me interrupt you, Isaac.
Yeah.
Hasn't there always been some presence of jumbo squid this high up in the Eastern Pacific?
Not that I had ever heard of prior to 2 years ago, 3 years ago. Had never heard anything.
No, I'm aware of jumbo squid going back about 15 years in the Pacific.
Yeah.
I think late 90s, and there's a lot of documentation from the early 2000s. Now, and the reason I bring it up is not to question this thinking as being fact, but to, again, reintroduce the possibility that the jumbo squid presence in a bigger range. Because remember, it's not just us in California, Oregon, and they've spotted squid all the way up to Alaska. But down in South America, there's a big presence of jumbo squid, too, that has that is considered beyond its normal reach. Now, the Humboldt Current, which runs a big stretch of the Eastern Pacific, is the jumbo squid range, as well as up into the Sea of Cortez, the Gulf of California. But again, north and south, especially in the past 10 years, we have a lot more record of jumbo squid, and it's coinciding with issues we have. There's already apparent documentation that the jumbo squid have wiped out juvenile rockfish stocks. You've heard of those reports?
I have. Yep.
And now there's suggestion that they could be wiping out, they could have impacted the salmon too. Now, I know there's a lot of study going on. We depend on this study because there's nothing else that's going to get us to where we need to be. Again, I believe that the natural cycle has to be introduced. And there are things, you know, there's so much I've been talking on the shows about and writing about lately. Stuff like the giant squid invasions, if you will. And then this historic red tide that we had here. The red tide, you know, we got the reports on the abalone, and at worst, in the popular abalone spots, at worst, the die-off was 30% of the abalone. So while historic, it's not catastrophic. How much of all of this could be a natural cycle that we only see every half century,
right,
every 40, 50, 60 years. I don't believe that these theories are out of the realm of possibility and think that they need to be included in study and, what do? Ruled out before they can be discounted. And I think that the natural cycle has so much to do with it. Do you remember how much we used to talk about El Nino and La Nina as the principal factors in the changes now? And now we're swimming. We really don't know what to, you know, El Nino, global warming. I don't think we really know what to pin it on. But I think one thing's sure, that the universities and the institutions, whether they're on our side of the coin or the other, which would be anti-fishing, are putting their research dollars into figuring this out because we have a common goal, even if it's an anti-fishing goal, and that's healthy, sustainable oceans. So we're in a peak period, I think, and especially it's amazing in a lousy economy. I think even in the struggling economy, there is funding going on. There is research. You know, I went to pick my girlfriend up at the saloon the other night. You know, I love saying that. Chip knows it. Michelle runs the saloon. But and a guy came in, actually went to say goodbye to, in a little town of Bodega. If you guys haven't watched the movie The Birds, I want you to go rent a copy because I make a lot of reference to it. The church and the schoolhouse where they had in the movie is right next to the casino saloon. I think it's been there since like 1865. And we went to, the owner is taken off. We went to say our goodbyes. And all of a sudden a guy walks in and asks for the Valley, do you know where the Valley Ford Inn is? Turned out he was a late night guest and he had just flown in through San Francisco from Arkansas via San Francisco. It's almost midnight. And he's got a 7 o'clock, I said, so what are you doing here? Wearing a suit and tie, I know he's not going fishing. And he was here to have meetings at the Bodega Bay Marine Lab. This is one of the world's foremost marine research centers, and it's associated with the University of California, Davis. And wherever I was going with this, there's still research money. And people are concerned about the oceans. They're concerned about everything from the fish swimming in the sea, and we've got so much to the sardines and fillets that are available to us in the supermarket. There's so much experience that we can grasp and that we need to look at, and I'm so dialed into the Pacific, but the truth is I've been watching the striped bass, the cod in the Atlantic. I've seen what's happened when Chef Paul Prudhomme was nearly single-handedly, or I should say with a single skillet, able to nearly wipe out the redfish population in Florida and the Gulf. And I've seen the shrimp go. I've seen what states do with regulations, what happens to recreational anglers, what happens to generations of commercial fishermen. But I'm always looking towards the future, and I'm thinking about everybody's kids and grandkids and their kids who we want to see fishing. And a show never goes by when I don't talk about my main drive in being in this business and being able to reach anglers is to promote sport fishing as a traditional American pastime, although it is a global traditional pastime, and a wholesome family activity. And it really is, and I can tell you story after story, but I'd rather hear from one of you guys.
So is it, what's going on with the lobster down in California? I haven't heard the news on that, and I'm kind of curious.
Well, thank you for asking, and thank you for letting me bust some news. I'm going to preface this, Isaac, with this is all hearsay, but most of my hearsay always comes from pretty good sources. And I called Captain Ernie Prieto, Ernie was one of the guys who used to sit with me at the bench 15 years ago as we hand-cranked out rocket launcher rod holders for the kayaks when we were just getting this sport going. It was the beginning of kayakfishing.com. We were talking to people everywhere. Ernie worked around the corner at the tackle shop, and a real, real popular guy, and a sick fisherman, a sixth-generation Mexican-American from Pasadena, who, as a lad, every week his dad and his grandpa would drag him out on a fishing boat, any fishing boat. They went on all of them. He grew up on the landings. And he would get seasick until he was a young adult, and he told me he finally got a feel for the swell. Now Ernie is the owner-operator of the Chubasco 2, Chubasco and the letter 2, the number 2.com, out of Point Loma, and with a handful of other party boat operators left on the California coast. And I got to say that because what it used to be is a lot different from what it is now. And Ernie's got the Chubasco, too. He's running half-day trips most every day. He runs three-quarter-day trips sometimes. He's fishing Point Loma, the La Jolla kelp, and he's running that boat of his with up to 40 passengers down to the Coronado Islands, which is just over the Mexico border, below Tijuana. It's a little cluster of island rocks off the Mexican coast for great yellowtail fishing, rock fishing. And, you know, now that I think about it, it's been a long time since I've been done mothership trips, but we've even done them on the Chubasco, too. We've been down there with, you know, instead of taking 40 people, you take 10 or 12 guys and girls and equal number of kayaks. You go out with the crew. And it is quite a day. We'll have to talk about mothership trips one day on the show. But anyway, Ernie is a great guy, and I was called him for an interview and to get some information because I know that he does fish the jumbo squid when they show up. We started talking about lobster, which, Isaac, if I'm not mistaken, it's just coming into season, I want to say the end of October, and it'll run through the winter. And here are the regulations for spiny lobster, which is the sweetest lobster in the sea, in my opinion. You can take 7 a day, or 7 a night, as it happens to be, because it's a nighttime fishery. They crawl best at night. So what we do, you can only fish them with hoop nets, no trapping. Those are the round ring nets that have a smaller ring in the middle where your bait goes. You put out 5 hoops. What we do is light a cigar, wait patiently, and then in cycles, check your nets. You go over and you haul them up. Now, we rig them real nice. We put a big float on them, maybe an empty soda bottle with a light stick in there, and they make these great electric light sticks. We got it down pretty well. We're fishing in, most of us are fishing in dry suits, dry pants and tops. For a real comfortable night, we got the coolers of hot cocoa out there. I mean, the thermoses of hot cocoa out there. And it really is a fun, fun way to fish. And when the bugs are crawling, in fact, the first hooping clinic I ever did, I had two guys, Rich and Fuzzy, came out, and it was their first time hooping on the kayaks. They came out to do a clinic, and they came out, I believe it was an 11-pound Pacific lobster.
Wow.
And they said they had been diving together for 20 years and had never pulled one in that big. And it was just a great experience. Anyway, the status of the fishery now is that you can take 7 lobsters a night and there's no annual bag limit. Fish and Game, in its effort to provide better data on the fishery, started using report cards a few years back. So anglers need to, at the end of the season, to fish the lobster, they need a lobster punch card, and
right.
They need to report at the end of the year what their take was. And let me pause. Excuse me. What they've discovered in the last few years is that the recreational take for spiny lobster is 30% higher than the commercial take.
Wow. Okay.
And there are lots of factors that enter into that, and not to bring doom and gloom on the Kayak Fishing Radio's Wild West show, but when lobster fetches the price that it fetches, like abalone, you're not going to be free of poaching issues. And with no bag limit, somebody who's selling to a market almost doesn't have to poach, but they do. And what's happening is anglers are taking hundreds and hundreds of lobsters off the reefs. 30% more than the commercial take is staggering. And it is being suggested now that Fish and Game is going to come down here pretty soon and put a bag limit on how many you can take. They may lower the daily take, but they probably should definitely put a quota on the annual take per angler.
Right. That makes some sense. You know, and this is really kind of news to me because we don't have the California lobster up here in Oregon. But as like I said, as a fishmonger, my understanding is the California spiny lobster is one of the most sustainable lobster species from around the world.
It has been.
It's a green tag. According to the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch program, it is a green-listed best choice sustainable seafood. So this is kind of news to me.
And I think it's a species that has been brought back. There was no lobster to catch for a long time. There was because of, and I don't want to blame this one just on overfishing. It really had a lot to do with pollution in Southern California. The crustaceans were really impacted. So when you add the pollution factor to overfishing, it's a significant problem. Now we started paying attention. We started regulating. We changed the laws that you can't hunt for lobster. It's free diving only, breath diving only. So no tanks to go down and take these bugs. And over the years, we've brought it back to, like you said, a green tag, healthy, sustainable fishery. However, when we get this kind of information that the recreational take is surpassing the commercial take, and we're talking to commercial guys on the water who are having trouble catching fish. Now, again, I'm not quick to jump and say, oh, we're taking too many bugs. We have years just like with the crab and everything else where some years are not so good and some years are absolutely flat. That's part of the natural cycle. But there is an imbalance when recreational anglers are taking more than the commercial take. I don't know, but that could be a first on a species that's also classified as a commercial species. I don't know that that's ever happened. I know recreational anglers have never taken more halibut, never taken more yellowtail, never taken more sea bass. But they look like they're taking more lobster. On a note of enforcement, the wardens on the water made a point of saying that the charter boats, I'm sorry, the party boats are not their principal focus when they're going out taking passengers hoop netting because they don't write citations. The boat crews know the regulations. They keep their passengers honest. They check for licenses. Whereas in the time spent interviewing one boat and not writing a citation, they can check four boats on the water, and they're finding a lot of poaching, they're finding a lot of ignorance, and they're finding a lot of violations.
Right.
So this is real interesting news. You know, I love the lobsters. I think that they are definitely one of the more delicious catches in the sea. And when we've seen, I think my whole point about this, Isaac, is that it's always been the recreational angler who's stood out and been the steward of the fisheries. This is one of the first times, and a lot of science, a lot of research has to go into this, just those simple abalone punch cards. Now we've got the science and the research, and we've got the opportunity to step out in front of this and keep it a green tag species before it gets all messed up, I think it gives us a chance, if not to act proactively for the fisheries, at least to act timely, and that's all positive news as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I can agree with that. That's interesting.
Isaac, have we had no chat room action tonight at all?
There's been a little bit of chat, but they're just kind of
chatting. I wanted to thank everybody who's listening for tuning in, and I've got an issue with my chat room here, so it's just giving me a blank page, but that's okay because you've got it there, Isaac, and I appreciate your man in that switchboard.
What do
you got coming up for the next week?
Well, you know, like I said, here it's all about salmon fishing right now in the Columbia River.
No news on the albacore?
You know what? The albacore season's pretty much done. There's another week or so.
All right.
And the seas haven't been cooperating. So
again, right.
Just
they're
doesn't look like that's going to happen.
Right here.
So,
and it wasn't a good showing this year for albacore, was it?
It wasn't the best, from what I understand. I haven't seen, you know, the boatloads of albacore that I've seen in years past, but they were closer. You know, we're talking about 20 to 30 miles, 20, 30, 40, as opposed to a normal year where 60, 80, yeah.
Yikes.
They were a lot closer in, but that's about it. So, yeah, I didn't hear anything about, you know, major takes of, you know, copious amounts of albacore. But they were out there.
Are you able to take salmon out of the Columbia?
Yes, sir.
Is that where you're fishing?
That's where I'm fishing. I'm 2 miles, maybe three, from the banks of the Columbia River. And the fishing the last week, week and a half, has been killer.
In the river itself or in the tributaries?
Fishing the river itself.
Great. Are you anchoring up on that river or are you pulling it around?
Anchor's the best way to go. It's my favorite way to go. There's a couple of areas that are good for trolling, but generally it's sit on the hook and hang out and enjoy the sun. So
I'm watching a osprey trying to pick fish off of the bay here, but it's really foggy, but I still think he's going to do better than I do today. you know, I was thinking about anchoring, and I talked to a lot of anglers fishing the rivers, especially Pennsylvania, the Susquehanna, big rivers, big slow rivers, and there aren't too many applications, I think. Maybe a lot of the guys in skinny water in Florida and the Gulf, but on the Pacific, there are not a lot of applications where we actually drop an anchor. In the open ocean, we've got the benefit of the coastal kelp and the giant kelp. Those are the big forests of sea plants that grow up on the coast. And I've actually perfected what I call surface anchoring, where I can tie up to the kelp in a big swell using a long tether that has a bungee on it and a quick release at the boat, because in the wrong situation, tying up on the top can really pull you right over if you get caught by a swell. But, you know, we're able to move around, especially fishing for lingcod and halibut, the rockfish complex. We're able to move around, fish a lot of areas. And there was this one day that, you know, it's all observation that's made me a better fisherman. And I'm not too proud to say that I can't count the days that I've been on a boat with other guys who are catching fish, and I just put my rod down to watch what they were doing because I wasn't catching fish. And I've learned a lot that way. And sometimes it's just been something little, like the style of hook or the length of leader or the amount of lead they had and the amount of weight on there, just that one little change that made a difference. And where the heck was I going with it all, Isaac? Oh, the anchoring thing.
The anchoring,
you know,
yeah.
There are so many in kayak fishing. There are so many specialty target areas that when you go to approach the fishery, and I think when it comes to an anchor, none is more prolific than fishing for sturgeon in a river or a bay. But, you know, for so many of us who are expert anglers, there's so much that we haven't done. And these are all particular specialties that, you know, if you're a destination angler, which so many kayak fishers tend to be, I am such a supporter of going to a new area and hiring a guide, you know, even if it's on their boat. And I tell them straight out, I fish a kayak. I want you to show me the fishery. And they want to do it. I mean, everybody wants to fish. And I learned so much from that. But these are the little particularities. And I got to tell you, anchoring is no little particularity. It's a big one. You've got to know. And a lot of these riggings I see coming out on kayaks, I believe, are very questionable. I think every fishery is different. And the way you rig your anchor, if you get a stock anchor system on your kayak, that, you know, a fancy gizmo, practice at the beginning. Don't go putting that thing in high seas. And I think what I'm really saying is learn its limits and what use is for that.
Yeah, there's a lot.
We're pulling it off.
Yeah, there's a lot that goes into anchoring, because especially up here, like I said, the Columbia River is by no means a small body of water. I use an 8-pound anchor on the kayak.
I believe it.
You know, and there's so many people that are like, 8 pounds? I'm like, yeah.
And what kind of anchor is it?
It's a mushroom.
It is a mushroom. So you're looking to get a little leverage in something down there.
Yeah, that's usually kind of sandy bottomed. So, yeah, I use the mushroom anchor. It's my favorite.
Will it hold you, 8 pounds will hold you on the sand? Or at least slow you down enough to fish?
Yeah, it will hold me. And, you know, I've got 100 feet of anchor rope out.
I heard that. Now,
you know,
do you break away from your anchor when you hook up?
All depends on what I'm hooked up to.
So there is a float on it. You have that. I guess every situation is different.
Yeah. I've got a big old crab float on there, and a boat bumper. If the current's really moving, I've got a couple of floats on there. There's times, especially during spring flows, where, you know, I'll be fishing 20 foot of water and I've got 100 feet of rope out and two floats. And with the kayak attached, those floats are still underwater.
Wow, so, that's some current.
Yeah. So, and you know, it's not for everybody, that's for sure. You know, there's been times where I've gone out and I've tried to drop anchor and realized there's no way I'm going to drop an anchor today. The way too much current. And, you know, you just got to be prepared at that point to fish another method or go home. You got to know when to say when.
You
got
to know
when
to call your day, that's for sure. You know, I'm sure you get a pretty good incidence of it up there, but we see a lot of fatalities on the coast here.
Yeah.
Not only the abalone divers, but from fishing too. And you know, the further you crawl north, I mean, cutting my teeth in Malibu, you know, I refer to it as Lake Malibu now, because the farther you move north on this eastern Pacific coast, the bigger and more unpredictable it gets. And when you hear stories about people walking their dog on the beach and getting sucked out by a wave, they're not kidding. It really happens. Normal days that you wouldn't think anything's going to come, just out of nowhere. Rogue waves are a reality.
That they are.
So you get any halibut fishing up there in the Great Northwest?
We do.
Those are all Pacific halibut, aren't they?
Yeah, they are Pacific halibut, not your little Californian halibut, the big Pacific.
Yeah, our little chickens.
You know, they're generally, we have an inshore fishery for those and an offshore fishery. Offshore being 3 or 4, I think it's 3 nautical miles is the dividing line there off the coast.
And what kind of depth are you talking?
Near shore, 200 feet.
No, offshore. Offshore.
Offshore, 600 feet.
You're fishing Pacific halibut at hundreds of feet.
Yeah, hundreds.
Wow.
Hundreds.
Wow.
When I was a kid, I caught 6-foot halibut off the north coast of Washington at 650 feet.
You use that 8-pound anchor for a weight?
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much, yeah. It was, it was, you know, when you're running out that far, you are using a couple of pounds of lead to get down.
Are you seeing the halibut fishery come back up there?
I don't, you know, the Oregon State marine biologists say yes. They increased quotas this year, which is pretty much unheard of these days. But they did increase the halibut quota this year. I don't know. You know, I haven't kept track to see if it was met or not. I know last year the halibut quota was done in a week or two. It was a really quick season.
And does that basically mean that the commercial anglers, when they reach their quota, it's done for everybody or what?
No, it's a quota for recreational.
It's a recreational quota. Wow.
Recreational quota. We have the same thing for salmon as well, recreational quotas. Because I don't think they're allowed to commercially fish for Pacific halibut.
I didn't know that.
Wrong, but I could be wrong. I haven't. It's been a long time since I looked into a lot of the Oregon fisheries, mostly because they're not a product that I would sell. So I haven't paid too much attention to the commercial fisheries.
Interesting. So it is impacted enough that it's not. You wouldn't put it in the shop.
No.
Interesting.
No, I would not.
Yep. What about Alaskan halibut?
Absolutely, in a heartbeat.
Yeah, and California halibut's okay too, isn't it?
I do believe California halibut follows as a good alternative, makes it yellow in the Seafood Watch program. But it's not something that I've ever ordered before, mostly because people want the Alaskan halibut. So I haven't even asked to see if it's available to me.
Right. Very interesting. I used to be the halibut king down in Malibu, and then I got into kayak fishing as a business, and all I could do was lead other people to them. There were days in the 80s and 90s, Isaac, where we would be releasing 20, 30, 35-pound halibuts because we had already taken that one more than we probably should have on a 5-fish limit. So I've got two in my boat and letting 5 more go, you know, almost 100 pounds worth of halibut. That's great fishing. Again, we haven't seen that in a lot of years. I don't know if it's cyclic. The halibut recovered here in a big way after we were able to outlaw the gill nets. But gill nets still exist on special permit. And I think some of those special permits might be abused. Also, we've got poaching issues with what they call bandit draggers. These are draggers come in at night with their lights off. They have scouts on shore. They have scouts on the water. And they drag the bottom, and that also devastates halibut and ground fish fisheries. So there's a lot of issues to it. I'm sorry?
And the habitat.
Wipes the habitat out, man. You want to? I mean, we know about dragging from the East Coast too. You want to talk about something that's devastating the seas? You know, it is clear cutting of the oceans at its finest.
Yep.
Isaac, thanks for joining me tonight. I like having you on board.
It's my pleasure. It's good to have two West Coast guys on the same show.
I like that. That way we can cover it border to border. And we want to thank everybody who signed on to the chat room tonight. I'll be back at the home broadcast center for next week's, and I'll be able to tune into the chat there. And I'm really excited about this. I hope everybody gets good weather and good conditions, gets out over the next weekend and week, comes back to fish in the Wild West with me and Isaac. We could use some reports. We could use some questions. We could use some chat and some chatter, and we appreciate your tuning in tonight. Isaac, you want to sign off for us?
Hey, I think you'd said it best, but, you know, on behalf of Dennis Spike, thanks for listening to Kayak Fishing Radio, the Wild West Show. Tune in next week.
Is that going to work?
That works.
Y'all have a great week. Good fishing, and think about keeping sport fishing as a traditional American pastime and a wholesome family activity. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next week at 5 Pacific time. Out.